Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, a fascinating look at a natural resource we had better get serious about conserving. The elixir of life, the universal solvent, H2O. Dr. Seth Darling explains all. I hope you'll stay tuned. A couple of years ago, there was a phrase that everybody was reciting. They still are. The phrase was, "Orange is the new black." Soon that metamorphosed into, "Black is the new black," which sounded even more hip and ironic. Since I stopped watching TV 25 years ago, I had no idea where the phrase came from. "Orange is the new black." You'd think the fashion business, but no, hardly a trace of orange on the racks. 20 minutes ago, I finally looked it up and found that the phrase is the title of a TV show on Netflix. A lady gets sent to federal prison where the season's must-have color is orange. Who knew? So, just as orange is the new black, so water may be the new oil. Here, we're not talking about salad dressing, we're talking about international conflict. Many of the wars of the 20th century have been about, to a large extent, the control of oil. Small wars, like the Civil War in Sudan, not to mention Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. And also big wars. A big reason that England and the U.S. entered what we now call World War I was to grab control of the oil of the Middle East. In World War II, why were Germany and Britain shooting at each other in the deserts of North Africa instead of moving all those tanks to Stalingrad? Three-letter word starts with O. Oil fights are not going to end, but in this century, water fights are going to become more and more common, and probably more and more vicious. There are alternatives to oil. Fresh water is even more vital than oil, and there is no alternative to it. The demand is growing very rapidly, and the supply cannot increase. Wars over water to drink will be a growing problem, but that's not the whole of it. The materials of civilization as we know it require huge amounts of water to manufacture. Generating electricity requires a staggering amount of fresh water. Modern agriculture requires a staggering amount of fresh water. For example, nearly 700 gallons of fresh water are needed to produce each gallon of cow's milk. Steel, plastic, clothing, you name it. We're talking many billions of gallons of water a day just in the United States. Fresh water only. Seawater won't work. Want some more bad news? Climate change is decreasing the water supply. When the glaciers finish melting, the Ganges River will be a dust bed, and the Indians are going to go on the warpath, so to speak. Today and next week, we'll hear all about it in a very interesting talk by a young scientist, Dr. Seth Darling, Ph.D. It's from him I got all of the information about water that I just recited. Darling is a postdoctoral fellow with the Argonne National Laboratory near Chicago. His approach is interdisciplinary. He combines chemistry, materials engineering, physics, biology, and a few other fields of science. He's obviously a very sharp guy and, mirabile dictu, a very good public speaker. Mirabile dictu is Latin. It means golly in academic jargon. Actually, Dr. Darling himself never uses the phrase. I just needed to remind everybody that he's not the only Ph.D. in the room. I'm just kidding. Water is the new oil also is my phrase, not Darling's. I think. If all my listeners were as old as I am, I would have titled this show, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Water, But Were Always Afraid to Ask. But how many would get the joke? So, water is the new oil, it is. Speaking at the University of Chicago in May 2016, here is Dr. Seth Darling.
Water has also driven a number of revolutions. It was transoceanic sailing that globalized civilization. Water wheels launched the Industrial Revolution. Watt's steam engine revolutionized transportation and industry. Sanitation of our water system extended human lifetimes by decades. Great dams, like Hoover Dam pictured here, finally gave mankind control over the fickle precipitation of Mother Nature, limiting both flooding and droughts. That allowed food production to increase, while at the same time giving you hydroelectric electricity. That is one of the reasons that the United States rose as a global power. And intermodal shipping containers have revolutionized global commerce. About 90% of commerce occurs on the water in our oceans. Water also controls our weather. So water comes into our lives in so many central ways. Let me ask you a question to test your knowledge on water here. So we use a lot of water in this country. Who do you think is the largest withdrawer? Where does most of our water get withdrawn in this country? Anybody? Agriculture was what I was expecting you to say. That's where most of our water is used, but I chose my words carefully here. I said withdrawn. Power plants. Power plants in our country withdraw over 200 billion gallons of water a day. And that's used in part to boil that water by burning coal or natural gas or nuclear heat or whatever to make steam, to turn turbines and make electricity, but also for cooling of those power plants. And so they return a lot of that water back to the lake or river that it came from, so it's not used in the sense that it is in agriculture. But they do withdraw much more than we do for agriculture. So that's one intimate connection between water and energy, that we use so much water to make the energy that we all use. But you can flip that around, too, and say, where does most of our energy go? Well, it turns out that the biggest user of our electricity is actually water treatment, distribution, and use. So it goes both ways. Energy and water are so interconnected that there's a name for it. It's called the water-energy nexus. And Argonne National Laboratory is a Department of Energy laboratory, so you might ask, why are we talking about water? Here's a big reason why we're talking about water, because water and energy are inextricable. In fact, here's a report that you can grab from online if you've got nothing to do for a few hours that was just published recently, see, in 2014, that really highlighted a lot of these interconnections between energy and water. I've just mentioned a few here, but there are many, many more. Okay, so water's clearly important, but it's invisible. Water is actually hidden all around us, even in this room. Let me give you an example. If you take 683 gallons of water, you can grow 6 pounds of alfalfa hay. If you take those 6 pounds of alfalfa hay and you feed them into a machine that looks like that, it will give you 1 gallon of milk. So in that single gallon of milk sitting in your fridge are represented almost 700 gallons of water. It's not just milk. It's all of the food that we use. A single grape, not a bunch of grapes, one grape is about a third of a gallon of water. One walnut, almost 5 gallons. One potato, nearly 7. A cup of coffee, and this isn't a venti latte frappuccino, we're talking about just a cup of coffee with nothing in it, is 37 gallons. If you do make it a latte, it's going to go way up, because as I explained a moment ago, dairy has a lot of embedded water in it. A single Greek yogurt is about 90 gallons. And the biggest culprit here would be meat, especially beef, which represents, in the case of a hamburger, over 600 gallons of water. But it's not just food. It's also the materials that we use. Steel. To make steel, you need water. To make 1 pound of steel, which is not a very big piece of steel, it would take 11 gallons of water. And this is true of all the other materials that we use. Plastic, cement, cotton, paper, all of them take water to make. What that means is that the clothes that you're all wearing, the phone that's in your pocket, the car that you drove to get here, all of those things have within them virtual water. So globally, we don't move water from one part of the world to another in any appreciable amount because the scales of water that we use are ginormous. To give you an example of that, the Jardine Water Plant here outside of Chicago processes as much water in one day as the entire volume of petroleum we use in the United States in that day. So that's the type of scales we're talking about. So you're not going to move that type of volume from one point to another, and I'll talk more about that later. But we do move virtual water around because all of the goods that we're shipping around the Earth have within them, as I just described, embedded water. And so there are folks who have looked at this and kind of tracked. There are countries that are net exporters of virtual water and countries that are net importers of virtual water. And perhaps it's not surprising when you see, for example, North Africa and the Middle East are net importers of virtual water. They're not bringing in water, but they're bringing in an awful lot of food, for example. And so we're moving a lot of water around, not all of which is sustainable water, and we're not policing this in any organized way. This is a policy problem that is going to have to be addressed going forward. Let me just give you one example. There's a company based in Saudi Arabia called Al Marai, which I'm told, I don't speak Arabic, but I'm told that means the pasture. There's no pasture in Saudi Arabia. The pasture in this case is in the American Southwest. So Al Marai is the largest vertically integrated dairy company in the world. And what they do is they extract groundwater in the Southwest. We'll get to groundwater a little bit later. And they use that to grow hay. And then they ship that hay to the dairy cows in the Mideast to make the dairy to use there. So they're actually moving massive amounts of groundwater, effectively, from the American Southwest, which is, as I'll describe, not sustainable, to another part of the world. These are things that we need to start paying much more attention to. So water is important, but in fact, it's becoming even more important as we go forward in time. So we don't have a shortage of water on Earth. There's an enormous amount of water on Earth, but unfortunately, the vast majority of it is in the oceans, salt water, which we can't use for much of anything in that form. So it's actually about 97% of the water on Earth is in our oceans, which translates to 350 quintillion some gallons. A lot of water. But you can't drink that stuff. You can't water your crops with it. You can't even put it through a power plant, in fact. The water that we all deal with is the fresh water, which represents less than 3% of the water on Earth. So how is this fresh water distributed, this less than 3% of the water? Well, there's the water that we see that, you know, evaporates, ends up in the clouds, comes down as rain and snow, and we see that in forms like Lake Michigan out there. That I would call renewable runoff. Some of that water is going to percolate down through the ground and form groundwater, aquifers. And as long as you withdraw that water at a slower pace than it's being replenished, it would be renewable. Of course, that's not what we're doing, though. In almost every case, when we start tapping these aquifers, we're withdrawing the water at a much faster rate than it's being replenished. And so in that sense, it's not truly renewable. There are other aquifers in the ground that are sometimes called fossil water, akin to fossil fuels. And it's not fossil in the sense like fossil fuels where it's made of fossilized organisms, but in the sense that it's been there for a really, really long time and is not being replenished at all. In some cases, hundreds of thousands of years, maybe even millions of years, some of these aquifers, when you tap those, that is a one-time use resource. An example of that, Libya. Libya built something called the Great Man-Made River, where they ran under the Sahara to bring fossil water for them to use for all the things we use water for. And they spent $32 billion U.S. dollars building that Great Man-Made River, and the projections are that it will only last about 20 years. At that point, they've expended that resource. So how is this less than 3% of water distributed? Well, all that stuff we see is only actually about 0.3% of the less than 3% of the water on Earth. About 30% of that less than 3% is in that groundwater. And I'm assuming you guys can do the math and see that that doesn't total up to 100. Where is the rest of that fresh water? It's locked up in places where we can't get at it. Things like glaciers and the permafrost and so on. So the amount of water we're talking about that we all use is actually a tiny fraction of that massive amount of water on Earth. What's worse, is that that resource is becoming even smaller. One of the reasons is because of climate change. So moment of self-promotion, that's a picture of a book that I wrote with a colleague at Argonne, How to Change Minds About Our Changing Climate, which combats all of the myths that you hear out there from the denial or skeptic community. One of the effects of climate change is that glaciers are melting. All over the planet, glaciers are melting. That's been very well documented now. The reason that's a big concern is that glaciers like those in the Tibetan Plateau in the Himalayas, the annual melt from those glaciers is the source of most of the major river systems in Asia. So the Indus and the Ganges and the Yangtze and the Yellow, all those rivers, that's where they get their water from. So when those glaciers disappear, those rivers are going to dry up. And that water is the source of water for about 1.5 billion people on Earth and growing. So where are all those people going to get water when those glaciers are gone or when they've shrunk enough that there's not enough water there? I don't have an answer for you. There's another issue with climate disruption, which is that we're getting more severe droughts than we've ever witnessed before. So this is well known to folks who live in California now, and all of us who buy the produce that is grown there, but other parts of the world too. The drought that's in the Middle East is said to be the worst in 900 years. And people will tell you that that drought led to food shortages, which has led to a lot of the civil unrest that's in that part of the world right now. What's going on in Syria was in part fed by food shortages, leading to refugee crises and everything else. So we've got a serious supply problem with water. It's a tiny supply, and it's shrinking. What about demand? Well, bad news there, too. Turns out demand is skyrocketing for water because of population growth and development. We just start using more water. Because remember, it's not just bathing and brushing your teeth and whatever. Anything you use, remember, has water in it. So as people start to have more things, that means they need more water. So it's projected that over the next 35 years, by the year 2050, global demand will rise at least 55%. So we've got shrinking supply, growing demand for a resource that we depend on for almost everything in our life. So what does that mean? It means that just like in the previous century where oil conflicts governed our geopolitics, in this century it's going to be water. We are going to have water-based conflicts, which are going to shape our century. And this is already happening. The Aral Sea is all but dried up in Central Asia, so the Fergana Valley is no longer fertile in the way it once was, and all of those Central Asian countries are sniping with each other now about those limited resources that are left. Same is going on in intrastate conflict in India. Another example from South America, the Salala River that flows from Bolivia into Chile. It goes into the Atacama Desert there, one of the driest places on Earth, and they need it for their mining operations in the Atacama Desert, which is one of the foundations of the Chilean economy. But that they want those water resources, but the Bolivians need them too, and if the Bolivians take more of that water, less of it gets to Chile, and so there's conflict between them now. The Nile Basin has been a source of water-based conflict since, as I told you, the time of the pharaohs, but this is still true today. You have countries on the tail end of the Nile, like Egypt, that rely on the Nile, but those headwaters are in Ethiopia and Kenya. And so that continues to be a source of struggle. And we all are familiar with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A lot of folks don't realize, though, that a big piece of that conflict revolves around the limited water resources in that region. Those draft agreements that get written up once in a while to find a peaceful solution, a chunk of that paperwork is actually devoted to water. So water is surely the most important material in the world. But as I told you, water is invisible. And this is not good for us or for water. So why is water so invisible? I think a good explanation for that is that for a long time, at least in the developed world, we've been living in what I call the golden age of water. So what do I mean by the golden age of water? When you're in the golden age, you have three things all at the same time. You have water that is abundant, safe, and cheap. When you have all three of those, you kind of start ignoring water. It doesn't seem so precious or rare anymore. It leads to things like this. If you stayed at a Four Points hotel a few years ago, the little water bottle that was in your room came with a placard on it that said that. It's water. Of course it's free. They were trying to make fun of the hotels that charge you $5 for a bottle of water, but what they're really doing is they're tapping into something primal about our relationship with water. We feel like it should be free. Why would I pay for water? And this mentality of, well, water should be free, there's plenty of it out there and it's safe and whatever, leads us to do things like this. Here in America, we flush almost 6 billion gallons of perfectly fresh drinking water down the toilet every day, literally. This is because you have one pipe of water coming into your house, and that water is drinkable. And you use that same water to flush your toilet or to drink or to wash your clothes or to water your lawn or whatever else you're doing with water. Remember the Romans. They were the ancient Romans. They had a better idea. You don't need to use the same quality of water for every purpose. It's time for us to start rethinking that. So how else do we waste water these days? Well, a lot of this is invisible to us under the ground in our water infrastructure, all those water mains. So you don't see them because they're under the streets and sidewalks, but they're in terrible condition. Many of them were built, you know, a century ago, and they're falling apart. So we spend tons of energy and other resources getting water so it's drinkable, cleaning up all the junk that ends up in water, and pumping it out into those water mains, and then one in every 6 of those gallons of water is just lost to leaks in those pipes underground, because there are so many. Speaking of our infrastructure, I'll tell you how underfunded that problem is. We actually spend about as much buying bottled water in this country as we do maintaining our entire water infrastructure, all the treatment plants, all those water mains, all of it. This is something like a $1 trillion infrastructure need that we have, and we're vastly underspending. How else is water disrespected? This isn't true so much here in the United States, but when you look globally, about 80% of sewage is just discharged untreated back into waterways. You can imagine the problems that that leads to with disease. Hydraulic fracturing impacts our water in many different ways negatively. Agricultural runoff. We put all this fertilizer on our crops with nitrogen and phosphorus and so on, and then either from irrigation or precipitation, a bunch of it gets washed away, ends up in places like the Gulf of Mexico. You get big algal blooms and dead zones. Huge problem in our waterways today. Heavy metals. This is familiar to anyone in Flint, Michigan these days, or anyone who reads the news, but there are plenty of other ways that heavy metals get into our water. What's pictured here was is a river in Colorado where, you might remember, it was maybe a year or two ago, the EPA accidentally released a bunch of water from a mine that was heavily polluted with heavy metals, and that was the actual color. That's not a false color. That was the color of the river after all those metals ended up in there. We also have lots of pathogens in our water, thanks to, in part, that untreated sewage. Another interesting thing that ends up in our water are these guys, so-called micropollutants. You can take water from your tap and find pretty much all of these things in there, even after it's gone through the treatment plant. The amounts are tiny. They're not relevant necessarily to us, but they're in there. So we are all taking Prozac and birth control in every glass of water. Maybe that's a good thing. So again, these amounts are not high enough to affect us, but they do start affecting ecologies. There have been studies showing some fish species that are affected by those hormones and they're not reproducing properly anymore, for example. So this golden age of water is ending. And this is going to reshape how we all live. It's going to change how our food is raised, how our communities are organized, and in fact, how our entire economy functions. So in the golden age, we had abundant, cheap, and safe. And you're probably going to be able to get 2 out of 3 in most cases. You can have water that's abundant and cheap if you haven't spent any energy cleaning it up, but you're probably not going to want to drink that stuff. You can have water that's abundant and safe if you spend a fortune cleaning it, like the state-of-the-art desalination plant pictured here. Or you can have cheap and safe water, but just not enough of it. Think California drought right now. So all of those are going to be situations of water crisis, which certainly is going to be happening a lot in the future, but if you look around the world, water crisis is already happening in many places. So on the next slide, to me, is the scariest statistic I show in any talk that I give. This, every time I read it, is amazing to me. Every 90 seconds, a child somewhere dies because of a water-related disease. Every 90 seconds. Think about how many children will be dead by the time we walk out of this room. There's no reason for this to be happening in 2016. millions of Indian girls and elsewhere, this is true in Africa and many other places too, are trapped by water. And what do I mean by that? They don't have water in their homes. They've got to go get water from some source, a well or otherwise, which on average is well over a mile away from their home. So what that means is all the water you have to use for everything, sanitation, washing your clothes, cooking, you name it, whatever you're going to use water for, every drop needs to be carried on their head from that site over a mile away. That takes so long to do that every day, they don't go to school. They never get to enter the economy and participate like their male siblings. This is another thing that needs to change. So you may have heard the famous quote, all politics is local. I like to say, all water is local. So I told you we can't move water easily from one region to another. And water needs vary dramatically as you look around the world because of precipitation and population and other things. But even if a water-poor region of the world wanted to buy water from us here, from our Great Lakes, we can't get it to them. You can't get enough water from Lake Michigan to Haiti or somewhere else where they would want water because you just can't move enough. So why don't we have these water pipelines to try and make it more equitable, the distribution of water? So one of the reasons, a very big reason, is the volumes involved, as I described earlier. You'd have to move a ridiculous amount of water, probably not even feasible to move that type of water over really large distances.
Scientist Dr. Seth Darling with part one of a very interesting talk about another natural resource we had better get serious about conserving. Dale Lehman of station WZRD in Chicago made available the original recording, which I have condensed a bit. Thanks to Dale. And thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, reminding you that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and hoping you'll tune in again for part two of Darling's talk next week. Ciao.